Welcome to the Audiobook Speakeasy. I'm Rich Miller, and I'm your host here at the Speakeasy. This is where you'll meet narrators, coaches, engineers, and other audiobook professionals, as well as some listeners who'll be sharing what they look for in a good audiobook. If you're interested in audiobook production, you've come to the right place. Tonight's Speakeasy Chat is being brought to you by Squeaky Cheese Productions on the Cutting Wedge. You can find them on the web at squeakycheeseproductions.com. So come on in, grab a drink, pull up a chair, and join us for a friendly chat about audiobooks. My guest tonight is not an audiobook narrator and not an audiobook coach. She also doesn't produce audiobooks or direct audiobooks. So you might be wondering, why do I have this person in the audiobook speakeasy? Well, the reason is because she is the Associate Executive Director for the Washington Mid-Atlantic Local of SAG-AFTRA. And while that title doesn't necessarily say anything about audiobooks, the fact is that that she and Rich Larkin are co-chief negotiators for audiobook contracts. Jane Love, thanks for joining me in the speakeasy tonight.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. I'm glad that you could make it. Somebody by the name of Byron Wagner introduced me to your name quite some time ago, and it's taken quite a long time for me to work it into my schedule and for you to work it into your schedule, so I'm glad that it finally did work out, and I think that now is a good time to be talking to somebody in the union.
Great. Yeah, I know, and Byron's been politely persistent, and I'm glad he was.
I am as well. I'll definitely give a shout out to him when this episode comes out. So, so this is the audiobook speakeasy, Jane. What are you drinking tonight?
Well, right now, I am actually just drinking water because I am on the clock, but I plan to, at the end of our session, I know exactly what I'm going to have, and it's my quarantine cooler of choice lately.
Oh, I look forward to hearing about that. We'll have to get to that at the end of the episode, right before you're ready to drink.
Okay. It's a good one, and I made it up.
Oh, excellent. I love homemade cocktail recipes, and I look forward to hearing the specifics so that I can try to duplicate it here. In the meantime, I will say that I also have a glass of water. One of the things that the quarantine, the stay-at-home orders, et cetera, have given me is a lot of time to do yard work. And so this morning, I was out doing a lot of yard work, and I ended up drinking a lot of water while I was doing it because it was mostly moving around heavy rocks. But I have found in the past half an hour or so that I think I need more. So I do have a glass of water. However, I am sharing the space on my booth desk here with a cocktail glass, and I'm having my latest new favorite bourbon cocktail called the Gold Rush, which I'd never heard of before, but apparently it's been around for sometime around 15 or 20 years, I believe. Somebody in the 2000s came up with it. And it's basically a cross between a whiskey sour and a bee's knees. I don't know if you're familiar with a bee's knees, but
I know them both. And in fact, I know a Gold Rush.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I don't remember exactly what goes into it, but there's a kind of a healthy restaurant chain that they have here in Atlanta and California called True Food Kitchen.
I have not heard of that.
Okay, and they have a Gold Rush on their menu, and I'm a bourbon drinker.
Well, you might like this then, depending on how much you like honey. So essentially a whiskey sour is, whiskey of choice and lemon juice and sweetener. And I don't like my drinks all that sweet, but this one, instead of using sugar, uses honey syrup. And the honey syrup you can kind of customize. I actually saw a comment from the guy who created this drink back in the 2000s saying that when he created it, they were using a 3-to-1 honey syrup, which is a lot of honey, a lot of sweetener. I'm just using a plain 1-to-1 honey syrup. And in fact, I use a little bit less than the recipe calls for and a little bit more lemon juice because I like my sours really sour. But basically just a 2-to-1 bourbon lemon juice and then add however much honey syrup you want. And I'm glad that I found this one because I really like this.
That sounds fantastic. It's gone on my list.
All right. Well, thank you for coming into the speakeasy, Jane. Cheers.
Cheers.
All right. So, Jane, where are you now?
I am in Fairfax, Virginia, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C.
Ah, okay. So you are not, you are neither on the West Coast or in New York.
I am in neither of those places. Although right. prior to all this, I was in both of those places pretty frequently, as you can imagine.
No doubt. These days, wherever you are is where you're staying. So DC, is that where you grew up, or are you a transplant?
I did grow up in this area, which is a little unusual because my father was a nuclear submarine captain in the Navy.
No kidding.
Yeah, he graduated from the Naval Academy in 1948 and was part of Admiral Rickover's original nuclear power class. But we came to the area after, when I was just before I turned four, Rich, we moved to Falls Church, Virginia. He was at the Pentagon. And but for one tour in San Diego, where he was the CO of the base at Point Loma, Coronado, overlooking mm-hmm. Coronado, mm-hmm. We just rented our home here and came back following that tour. And he ultimately, when he retired from the Navy, went to law school at Georgetown and had a little practice.
Oh, wow. So not the typical story of a military brat going to different cities every 18 months or so.
Well, the story there is more about my rank and my family. My siblings and I are all 5 years apart. He wasn't home very often. So by the time I came along, I'm the youngest. My oldest brother's 15 years older than I am. By the time I came along, they had moved 28 times in the 26 years he was in the Navy.
And your mom said, never again.
Well, I mean, I did a couple of them early on. We were in near Dover, New Hampshire. I mean, New London and Groton and stuff when I was very, very young, but I don't remember.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So you are close to where you grew up then?
I am. I'm right down the road, and my mom is actually in a memory care unit right, 20 minutes from me, which, thank goodness, is so far coronavirus free.
That's good. I just got word last week that the assisted living facility where my dad is, they finally have a couple of cases, and
I'm sorry.
Yeah, me too. Fortunately, the way it's laid out is a little bit different. We visited a lot of different types of facilities before we moved him here, and we liked this one, and it's turning out right now, who would have known, but it turns out that it was actually a good choice. They're separate villas, and there are 10 residents in each villa, and so for whatever reason, two of the villas ended up getting cases. They actually started a lockdown a month ago, which was a little early for a lot of the nursing home and assisted living facilities. And mm-hmm. they apparently did a pretty darn good job, but it did eventually get into a couple. But that means that they can isolate it pretty well. And
sure.
They now have dedicated staff in those two houses. And I'm hoping it doesn't get to his. But honestly, who knows where people go when they leave their shift, who they come into contact with, whether or not they wear a mask, whether or not anybody they know is infected. I won't be at all surprised if it gets there. I will certainly not be happy about it, but what are you going to do?
I am in the exact same boat as are many of your listeners, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a shame, but that is the elderly is, the segment of the population that's most at risk. And there are a lot of places where there are a lot of elderly people in the same place.
Yes.
Yeah, that's too bad. It is good that she's close, though. So I'm sure that they're on some sort of lockdown as well, which makes it difficult. I know that I was seeing my dad every couple of days. I haven't seen him for a month. I'm fairly certain that he's not aware of that, but it is kind of weird for me.
I know they are definitely on a lockdown, and it's been longer than a month. The one thing that they've been lovely about is they FaceTime with me on a rotating basis between me and my siblings every Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So we at least see her, and she is she's 94 and in advanced stages of dementia, and so she's definitely not aware that we're not coming in and out.
Yeah, that's the way that I'm thinking is the case with my dad as well. And unfortunately, the technology solutions, I'd like to avail myself of those, and my sister would as well, but we're pretty sure it's not going to work out too well. So his birthday is coming up, and I might actually try to do a through the window sort of wave and say hi, greeting, happy birthday kind of thing.
Aww.
I'm not really sure how that's going to go either, but we'll see. You do what you can.
Yeah, we were really surprised actually that they made that offer. She, to do the FaceTime. Certainly she wouldn't be able to on her own.
Yeah. Well, that's good that you're close by. Hopefully this blows over and we all survive it and you can see her again sometime soon. So did you go to school in that area as well, or go someplace else, or just skip it all together?
You mean for college or?
Yeah. Yeah.
I graduated from the University of Virginia. And then I did my master's degree at American University in DC.
So all close to the DC area.
Yeah. I'm kind of, yes. I'm a homebody.
Well, my understanding is that a lot of the early audiobook work took place in the DC area.
That's exactly right. You're good with your history. That a gentleman you may know by the name of Grover Gardner.
I've heard of him. Yes.
Got involved, early on, and trained. I'll get in trouble for saying this because I love all my audiobook peeps, but. Trained some of the most prolific audiobook narrators, out there.
Yeah, I know. I think that it was Barbara Rosenblatt that was telling me about that time frame, and somebody else as well, and I can't remember who now.
The names that come to mind, readily, and I'll leave somebody out by mistake, but Kate Redding and Sean Pratt.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I was thinking with Sean and Marguerite Gavin.
Right.
Yeah.
And Michael Kramer, who's Kate's husband. And it's amazing. They've just done a ton of work.
Kind of a hotbed back then. Well, that's cool. But you didn't go into audiobooks. What were you doing when you got out of school?
When I got out of school, my kids make fun of me because I was an English major undergrad, and my master's is actually in journalism and public affairs. And from there, pretty soon into the master's program, I really decided I didn't really think I wanted to be a journalist, interestingly. But from there, I went on to a sort of an accidental short career in film and television production. Started out as a set PA and moved into positions as what we call APOC and POC, assistant production office coordinator and production office coordinators. And I worked on films that would come to the DC area, or often I was on shows in Richmond, Virginia. And I would live like a vagabond for 4 months, down there, and work 7 days a week and 15-hour days. And after a particularly rough show, I came home, and true story, it was one of the casting directors who, basically said that she thought I should get out of this business. And, she actually told me I was getting fat and didn't look good and didn't look like I was resting very much, to be perfectly honest with you. And she said,
I'm sure with the best of intentions.
She's a character, this one. And she said, I'll get you a job at the union. And I didn't even know what she was talking about. I mean, in my job for the film companies, I would type up and literally type them on a typewriter. Type up performer contracts and things of that nature. So, I knew some things, but it wasn't like I was really familiar with the union contracts through and through. Mm-hmm. But that's how it worked out. I actually was sitting home on my couch and got a call from the executive director of the local, or the assistant executive director of the local, who has been my boss in terms of the local activities for 30 years now.
Wow, no kidding. So
yes.
So that was pretty early then. And so you went in a direction that you had no intention of going into or pre-existing interest in, but you've stayed there that long. So I'm hoping that means that you love it.
I love it. And I will tell you, you're exactly right. I'm sitting here nodding my head. I had no idea that it would become a career. For me, that I you know, grew to love. I started out in a very entry-level position, you know, processing talent checks and answering questions about, you know, commercial rates and what we then called industrial rates. Now we're calling it, you know, corporate educational non-broadcast stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was 1989 and I was 25 years old, I think. And I have been very fortunate I was promoted to assistant executive director of the local way back in 94. I began to take on a lot of different responsibilities. The audiobook piece has been the happiest of those sort of accidents, I would say.
Oh, that's good to hear. I'm always so impressed with the audiobook community in general. Both the producers that I've spoken with here in the Speakeasy and at APAC and through email, and most all of the narrators as well, that it's good to hear that from the union side, which of course is not 100% of the people who are doing audiobooks, but I'm glad to hear that that other piece of the puzzle here has also been a very good experience for you.
I share your admiration for the whole community, and I mean it when I say community. We have very good relationships, we think, with industry, as well as obviously the narrators who I've come to know and love.
Yeah, no, that's great. And so, you said that you have been the associate executive director for that local for quite some time now. When did the audiobook piece start to become? I mean, has that always been a piece of it, or is it more recent that that's become a larger piece?
It's more recent. I mean, I was a contact for audiobooks for AFTRA.
Before the merger, yeah.
Forever. But the reality is, Rich, that there wasn't a great deal of work going on under the union contracts, you know, so I was a contact sort of in name only for a long time. What really started to turn things around was in, you know, prior to 2008, the union really only had, I want to say it was like three legitimate functioning contracts, one with Recorded Books, and I believe the other two were with companies that have since gone out of business. And they were all in New York, right? And everything else was non-union and was the wild, wild west. And I got a call one day from the executive director in New York who asked if I would be willing to come up and meet with the people at Audible. And it wasn't my place to do without permission, you know, from my boss to be released to go do something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So I made a suggestion to that colleague that he should ask Rich Larkin to do it, who is a great news and broadcast negotiator. And he took me up on that. And so long story short, Rich, you know, it wasn't as easy as just, you know, sitting down and hammering out a deal. There was a lot of work involved in all of that. But once we got that first agreement with Audible, and I realized that we were going to be given some flexibility to be able to kind of, you know, listen to what the publishers needed and do things in a way that made sense for them, then I started to get involved, and really accidentally we became this sort of team. I mean, I'll give you an example. The contract that AFTRA was using was a contract that was a studio hour contract. Mm-hmm. And so really we were able to, with that first agreement with Audible, you know, make the switch that the industry really wanted and needed to a per finished hour agreement. I mean, the arguments that we kept getting over and over again is that, you know, they don't necessarily want to pay more money to somebody, you know, because they're slower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and you said that was back in 2008?
Late 2008, we got the first tentative agreement with Audible. And then I'll never forget, I had, I called a meeting of all the Washington area narrators, and Rich came down. And within a couple of days of that meeting, we had additional signatories that, because the narrators called them up and said, hey, I really would love to be able to get health coverage and a retirement. And would you do this for me? And I remember specifically Gildan Media, which is now you know, owned by the Recorded Books Group, was one of the first ones to sign, and it progressed from there.
And you said that you got inquiries within days of setting something up with Audible.
Within days of having this, within days of having the meeting with the narrators in my area, showing them, you know, explaining to them what it could look like and how simple it could be.
That's great. Yeah, that's really good to hear that meeting with narrators, and then they were able to spread the word with their contacts. So clearly it has union activity in this area of voiceover has sort of snowballed. How have things changed that you've seen over the years?
In terms of what, Rich, precisely?
In terms of union activity, people joining the union, union members who are using this performance area as part of their overall plan of being an actor and anything else that they might do through the union?
Sure. Well, it's grown tremendously, but the reality is a lot of what we had going on, frankly, were people who were already members of the union. It just was an area that wasn't organized, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we finally were able to coax enough of the narrators, for instance, in Los Angeles, that was largely, if not entirely, you know, non-union. So people were a little reluctant to come in and talk to us, even our own members initially, because they weren't sure about us, right? And mm-hmm. they weren't sure, you know, they weren't sure that it wasn't sort of like some sort of punitive thing, you know, about, you know, working non-union or anything, which of course it wasn't. But once we began to explain to people our vision and what we wanted to do and how we wanted to do it, and that we were going to do it in a way that would make sense and that the publishers would go along with. I'll never forget, we had a meeting in Los Angeles early on. It was probably in 2010. And Penguin Random House came to the meeting and said, we don't have an objection to doing this way.
Oh, that's great.
Nobody be scared about it. It was wonderful.
And there were union members there who were sort of hesitant because they didn't know how the publishers would respond.
Right. I mean, then not everybody was willing to, you know, back then people were understandably a little skeptical, right? The union hadn't had an approach really necessarily that had produced a lot of results. And
well, that's great that PRH would be there. And I'm sure that allayed a lot of fears then.
Oh, absolutely. But I think my point is, so when you ask about how things have changed, I think one of the most dramatic things for me is that initially people were sort of a little reluctant to take action, right? Like mm-hmm. if somebody wasn't playing ball, they weren't necessarily so wild about the notion or convinced that collectively withholding services, for example, which, you know, is kind of negative. I don't want to dwell on it, but that they had power, you know, together. Mm-hmm. And that has definitely changed. When we have had situations where we've needed support from the community, I mean, we have literally obtained 300 signatures in a 24-hour period on letters to recalcitrant producers or publishers.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Another thing.
Do you know what I mean? So I think
speaks well to the narrator community.
Yeah, one of the biggest changes I think is activism, and you know. And of course, we are still, our contracts are still sort of in their infancy, right? And so, you know, other changes are things that narrators expect and in many cases, you know, deserve in terms of contract protections, you know. So there it's changing in that their expectations in terms of what they should, how they should be protected. That has sort of changed for me too. You know, in the beginning, they were just happy to have the health and retirement contribution. And now there are a lot of things that people want to make sure that we're looking at and looking after.
That's a great topic that I'm sure we could discuss for hours, just that alone. But give me one example of a protection, something that you would consider a protection that gets put into a contract as a way to let people out there who are listening who maybe aren't members of the union or are, you know, new members and they don't know that much about how things work. What it seems to me that that's a good way to point to a benefit of union membership is the union is looking out for you. Here's one example of how.
Yeah, I mean, I have a ton of things that I think are clear benefits of membership that, you know, we can discuss as much or as little as you like. But you know what I'm talking about, and I don't mean this in any sort of corny or hokey way. Is that members drive the priorities for our bargaining with these companies. So I'd like to try not to be too specific about any one particular company, but for example, recently, I will say, one of our negotiations involved a very important conversation about the way corrections are delivered to a narrator, right?
Mm-hmm.
This particular company did not provide sound files. And that was a real priority. We had agreed to a first contract without that. It was becoming a real problem for people in terms of, you know, hunt and pecking around. It was creating a lot of complications. This is a really small example.
No, but I think it's perfect because, as you said, there are many, many things that could go into this conversation. But I think a small example is really good for this sort of conversation.
Okay, well, so my point is just that we were able to, you know, through the process of dialoguing with, as you know, many of our member narrators who worked for this particular company, to identify that this was a huge priority for people. Not in lieu of rate increases or anything, but maybe in lieu of something else, like payment for research or something. You know what I'm saying? You have to figure out which companies. And so we were able to get that added into our corrections language, that in addition to, you know, the spreadsheet and the PDF pages marked and all that, that they would send the appropriate sound files to accompany that. And that was a big deal to people.
I'm sure. I have seen conversations about that online. I haven't seen, so I'm not going to out whoever the company is because I don't know, because I haven't seen specifics, but I have seen many conversations online about the different ways that people get requests for pickups. And I do remember a conversation in the not too distant past where it was clear that there were people who were unhappy about not having a voice match file. So I think that's great. I think that's a perfect example of the kind of thing that I'm thinking of. So as you said, I'm sure that there are many, but that's a good small example for somebody who's listening who might not be familiar with the union. Why should I join the union? A good example of how the union can provide a benefit that might affect a lot of people, whether or not it's a specific concern to any one individual.
And I'll just say in a general way, Rich, that also, you know, anytime a company changes terms and conditions of employment, even during a contract, that is, you know, grounds for us to get involved. So we've turned back a lot of things that involve, frankly, shifting work assignments from, you know, engineers and editors to narrators.
Shifting who it is that's supposed to take care of something.
Yeah. So, you know, any real significant changes, again, I don't want to be too specific because it would be calling out companies who have endeavored to do that in some way.
Right. I understand that you don't want to put a negative spin on something when the end result is positive.
Sure. Yeah. But yeah. I'm, you know, there are plenty of examples, you know, where something new, a new process comes up, you know, during the term of the agreement that our member narrators don't like and don't think that they should have to be responsible for. And we've been able to successfully intervene time and time again. I mean, there's lots of reasons why you want to be a member. I mean, you know, access to the credit union and, you know, probably the best healthcare and dental insurance, life insurance, loss of voice insurance, you know, retirement, et cetera. I'm not, you know, putting that, any of that down right now. COVID relief through the SAG-AFTRA Foundation, they've given out millions of dollars in assistance. But But that's what we do. That's what we do for the narrators is we bargain the best contracts we can with their input about what the top priorities are.
That's great. Speaking of health, I know that, as you mentioned, that is one of the biggest concerns for a lot of people. Is that something that you have much information on in terms of the health, the specific health benefits?
Well, I'm a participant, so but I can tell you that the best place for people to go is to SAG-AFTRA plans.org.
Okay.
SAG-AFTRA plans altogether. There's a summary plan description there. There is information about the earnings thresholds necessary to qualify. There is information.
So if I remember correctly, you have to make a certain amount per year. Is that correct? Or is it broken up
quarterly?
Yearly. Okay.
It's a little more complicated than that, actually. It's any four consecutive calendar quarters for your first year. So some people have a different, because you gain eligibility and then you are picked up for coverage the following quarter.
Okay.
So you could have a different eligibility year than a calendar year, mm-hmm. and you could have a different coverage year from a calendar year as a result. But at any rate, and information on the premiums, I may be wrong about this and I can check right now, but for me to cover my family, and it's the same for members, I think it's around $400 a quarter, not a month, a quarter.
Wow. I'll just pick myself up off the floor now because that's far different.
It's incredible
from what I'm dealing with. So that is certainly, I understand why that is a huge benefit that, or that it is a benefit that many people consider the one of the most important reasons. But since you mentioned it, I thought I would find out. That's great. So SAG-AFTRAplans.org.
Yeah, all the information is there. Separate and apart from that, AFTRAretirement.org. That's where the contributions on audiobook and other legacy AFTRA contracts go, because the pension plans have not merged yet. The health plans have merged.
Okay. So there was a recent kind of dust up that was all over social media about one company who is a signatory, as I understand it. And there was some indication that they were going to be moving in the direction of using artificial intelligence and creating voices instead of using narrators. And I know that the union was called in on that and there were conversations. Is that something that you can speak about, or is that more of a behind the scenes private kind of thing that needs to stay that way?
No, I mean, I can speak generally about AI. You may have even received our communication about it. Our narrator emails often include non-members, we have told the audiobook steering committee members, for example, that they can share it. So, but that's a really good example. We think that, and my note to the community said it right out, AI is coming, right? It is here in some cases. And our job is not to try to stop the train from leaving the station. We don't believe. I don't think that's productive or useful or going to happen. Mm-hmm. So our job is to intelligently think about how to monetize it in a way that makes sense. For example, just sort of, you know, in broad brush strokes, certainly there has to be session fees, but that can't be the end of it. And there's got to be, you know, so there's got to be licensing fees and limitations on you, very clear limitations on use that makes sense. So I was talking to a group of narrators about this topic. My days are running together, Rich, but I think it was just yesterday. Yes, yesterday afternoon.
Funny how that happens when everything takes place at home, right?
Yeah, it is. I do have to look at my calendar sometimes, but anyway.
I'm the same way. Oh, that was a week ago. Oh no, it was just yesterday.
and I'm the type of person who's guilty of saying that something that occurred a year ago, I say something occurred a year ago and it really happened 5 years ago. So I'm no good to begin with. But at any rate, I was on with a group of narrators about this topic, And, you know, we were discussing the idea, and one of the narrators, I'll just steal his line, said, well, he's not so sure he would have a problem with being on vacation in Mexico and, you know, getting checks for AI books based on his voice. Now, I also don't want to be glib about how serious it is, right? Mm-hmm. But the important thing is, and the point that has been made to us by companies, and I don't want to, I'm not naive, and I'm not trying to say that, you know, I'm falling for this, but if you look at how many eBooks there are in Amazon versus how many audiobooks there are, there the argument that we've been hearing, and I'd be interested to hear, you know, from your listeners or you or anybody, you know, what you think about this, but their argument is that they're not all going to get done on with a human narration, that it's not possible and it's not cost effective for mm-hmm. the, you know, the rights holder or the publisher or anything. And so, you know, if there's a way to figure this out, we're committed to figuring this out in a way that makes sense. And I also want to reiterate what I put in that communication to the community. This is going to be a SAG-AFTRA-wide matter. So we will certainly be coordinating too with our colleagues who are thinking about it as well in terms of, you know, commercials and promos and all kinds of other areas.
Yeah, good point, because audiobooks is just one area of voiceover, and it's a very unique area as far as I'm concerned, and I know a lot of other people feel that way as well, but it is only one area. And of course, if AI can be used for audiobooks, then presumably it can be used in all of the other areas as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know if you listened to any of the, you know, the samples from the Deep Zen stuff.
But I have not yet. I still have the tab open in my browser, and I plan to. I did hear when Google came out with, I can't even remember the product name, when there was a big pushback with their examples of calling to make an appointment or calling to get a reservation. And it is pretty remarkable. Yeah. It is, the technology is pretty remarkable. It doesn't surprise me that this is a union-wide issue for other areas as well.
But I think it's important, and I do think it's important to, again, not to be too much of a cheerleader here, but to be a part of a collective. You know, that's the way you can stand together. You know, if we get input from people, and then we go and have these fights with the companies and come up with, you know, reasonable barriers around this so that, you know, nothing happens like what apparently, you know, has happened around, you know, Siri and other examples. That's going to be a big deal, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. So if somebody is interested and says, I agree with you, Jane, I think that there is value for a collective, but I'm not a member of the union right now. Where should I go to find out more information about the union and to see whether or not it's the right move for me right now?
Well, if they're an audiobook narrator, I am delighted to take those inquiries, and I pride myself on being a straight shooter and, you know, answering questions openly and honestly. So people are more than welcome to reach out to me. I mean, I don't know that you can get the kind of information, all the information that you want from our website, but our website is an incredible resource as well, sagafter.org.
Is that SAG-AFTRA with a hyphen or no hyphen?
It's not. It's just
no
all together.
SAG-AFTRA.
Correct.
Okay. So that's one resource. And then people can reach out to you. Where can they do that?
They can do that right now via email is the best, but generally I like to set up a phone call if I can. But if they could email me to so we could schedule that, that'd be great. I'm actually busier than ever, which is wonderful. But it's Jane, J-A-N-E dot love, L-O-V-E, at SAG-AFTRA, all together, same, no dot, no hyphen, no underscore, .org.
Okay, cool. And then if somebody decides they do want to join the union, Real quickly, walk me through what that process is like. What do you have to do in order to make that happen?
Sure. So this is, it's a little bit different in audiobooks because it is somewhat of a manual process. So typically what happens, and it's kind of interesting, I was just talking to a narrator the other day who said that he kept checking. We have an eligibility tracker embedded into our website, and he kept checking and none of his work was showing up there. And I said, there's a really specific reason for that, that I won't bore you with. But it is sort of a manual process in audiobooks in that the person would reach out to me and I will find a title that they've done on one of the health and retirement contribution reporting forms. So for instance, someone would reach out to me and say, hey, I just completed a book for Tantor 2 months ago or a month ago, and I would now like to join. We are sent copies of all those reports. That verifies that you've had work under a union audiobook contract. And then our membership department makes that person eligible and walks them through the rest of the process. And I really do back out of that mostly. So I'm not the expert on the application process or really any details around. I do know that we offer a payment plan, but the specifics of it, for example, I'm really not that familiar with.
Okay, no, that's fine. But that brings up a good question. Does somebody have to have narrated a book that was for a publisher under a union contract in order to join the union?
Yes. And that's not hard to do because the publishers are by and large required to cover everybody. So for instance, if a narrator has ever been hired by Audible Studios, Blackstone, you know, on and on and on, they are eligible. They just may not know it.
What about narrators who have only narrated books through ACX?
So the opportunity is there, and people have joined the union via that vehicle. Thanks for asking. But unfortunately, you do have to negotiate at least 250 per finished hour is the current minimum. We happen to think that's really low for full production anyway, but that's just my personal opinion. Mm-hmm. And I know Rich Larkin shares it, but if you are able to negotiate that amount, the ACX system should and does, I believe, provide the option of choosing union coverage. So people can do that. We also used to cover the books that were done through the Audible stipend program plus mm-hmm. royalty share.
Yeah.
We have not quite figured out, this is another good example. Last time around in our negotiations with Audible, one of our proposals was that they find a way to allow author-paid stipends, rights holder-paid stipends, to work in that scenario. And they're conceptually all on board. It's just been very difficult for them to figure out, and I'm not casting aspersions, I think it is complicated, how to make sure that they are able to monitor that and make sure that they are aware of it and therefore they are compliant mm-hmm. and, you know, and making those contributions into the plans, not only on the stipend, but on the ongoing royalties.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's good. That is all great information. If you had, as somebody who is working for the union, you have a very specific view of how things work as opposed to somebody who is maybe a producer or a director. From your perspective, what advice would you give narrators generally?
Oh boy. On what sort of aspect?
Basically what I'm thinking is most of the people who listen to this podcast, not everybody, but most of the listeners are narrators. And they are building a business.
Right.
This is not something, this might be something that they are doing part-time, but they are hoping to go full-time. There are absolutely people who are doing this part-time or in retirement and have no intention of making a big business out of it. But there are a lot of people who are looking at doing this as their job, even if it's not their only job right now. And so what I'm thinking is, as somebody who is a union representative, I think that you have a lot of insight into people who do creative work for a living, and that is their only job. And so that's what I'm thinking of, is what advice would you give just in general to somebody who's going in that direction?
That's a really tough one, to be honest with you. I think the only thing that I can think of off the top of my head is pretty much mastering the obvious, unfortunately. I would caution people, to the extent possible, against putting all your eggs in one basket. I would work very hard to diversify my client base, because, you know, we all went through that Audible spike, you know, where people were just working, you know, with Audible, and then it sort of leveled off. Or, you know, I've had a couple of people recently tell me that, you know, they were working constantly for a particular publisher who was keeping them employed almost, you know, full time. And for whatever reason, you know, that dried up, and they're struggling a little to, you know, so I know that's everybody's goal, but I would attempt to get on as many rosters as possible. You know, we have a contact list. Unfortunately, we do regard that as a membership, a benefit of membership, but, you know, we put together a list of people, you know, who have agreed to accept submissions and how they want to be contacted and what they want to receive in that submission. That has been a resource, I think, to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Let me think. What else? Is there something you were looking for in particular that you think I might be able to offer?
No, not specifically. I was just thinking that you are in an organization that deals with creative people. They're in lots and lots of different capacities. This is just one tiny little corner of that world, and yet you see a lot. I'm sure that you see a lot of things in a lot of different areas that are similar in terms of people who are pursuing that type of career. I honestly think that what you just said is great, just from my own experience and perspective, is great advice. I know somebody locally who is not an audiobook narrator, but who has been in voiceover for, I think, decades at this point. And in one fell swoop, he lost half of his business because one person who was employing him decided not to use that type of service anymore. And so from people who I know and from my own experience, I think that what you just said is great advice. Don't put all your eggs into the ACX basket or to one specific publisher basket, because you never know what's going to happen next month, next year, whether it's the industry or the company or anything.
Yeah, I mean, and I know that that's probably could be a little eye rolling to some listeners who probably have been, you know, reaching out to all the big publishers and, you know, not getting on the roster kind of thing. So I don't mean to be, you know, glib about it. But I do think that that's something that as a business person, one should continue to work on without, of course, being annoying to that company. I mean, you have mm-hmm. to sort of balance how often you send materials or updates or check in, or, you know, to see if maybe they have anything for you. But I do think that that should be part of any person's business plan for themselves.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I just listened to the APA webcast recently, where one of the casting directors was talking about somebody emailing her every day for 2 months. And I'm sure that most of us who are listening were just like, oh my God, I would never do that.
Yeah, I know people can get a little desperate, and I understand these are particularly terrible times. I mean, the only other thing that I was going to say is, and it might be, it's totally obvious and perhaps a little controversial, but I think that if it's, you know, this is a lesson, right? That if it's at all, if it's possible for you, you know, if you're not in the noisiest part, you know, of Manhattan in a dime size apartment, you know, whatever you can do to try to set yourself up at home, I'm assuming most of your listeners already have, even if that means working with an engineer. I mean, there's narrators out there just being so clever about all this, right? And working, mm-hmm. you know, through Source Connect now, et cetera, with an engineer who's, you know, the engineer is in his or her home.
Right.
That obviously makes you a little, makes you more pandemic proof for sure.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, this is tough time. And I wanted to be able to say that anybody out there, union, non-union, whatever, I'm so very grateful that so much of, that this industry seems to be just ticking along without interruption. You know, the calls and emails and conversations that I'm having is all about, you know, quoting rates or how do I deal with this situation? And I'll just give you one little anecdote. I received a picture, Rich and I both received a picture from a narrator couple who was asked to do a video promo for Audible in their home, which, by the way, is covered under the contract and pays pretty well. And they sent a picture of how it all worked out and how smoothly it went and how great it was. And so it's just amazing what
that's great.
The work that is continuing.
Yeah, no, that's great. I have seen a lot of that online. People so grateful for being able to do this, as am I, having built my booth a couple of years ago. And I had a decent recording space before that, but this is much better. And it is great, you know, to be in an industry where that's possible. So, so Jane, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming in.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. My gold rush is gone. And now I want to hear what you're going to drink the minute we break this call.
Oh my gosh. And it might be the minute we break this call. So it's a homemade concoction that I invented during this, this time in our world. And and I don't have exact measurements, so I'm sorry. I'm kind of a not a cocktail guru, but
all right. That'll just give me an opportunity to tinker.
I did bartend in Georgetown in D.C. back in my graduate school days, but that's another story. so yeah, you're just gonna have to tinker. So it's bourbon. It's a homemade spiced simple syrup where I've put nutmeg and cloves and cinnamon. And,
So it's like half and half sugar water, but then you also put spices in and then strain them?
Yes.
Nice. Okay. All right.
And then this is going to be too sweet for you. So you might want to do something, adjust this a little bit, but I add a fair amount of apple cider and then a big hunk of lemon. So you could just do a lot more lemon juice. And the key for me, it's delicious on its own, just like that. But the key for me was the other night I added at the end, not strained, not in the syrup, a tiny bit of cardamom spice.
Oh,
on top.
All right. So you've got bourbon, apple mm-hmm. cider, and I assume you mean regular apple cider, not hard cider.
Regular apple cider.
All right. Bourbon, apple cider, lemon juice, and spiced simple syrup. With a pinch of cardamom.
Correct.
All right. So my wife is not a whiskey drinker, and yet she actually kind of liked the Gold Rush. Didn't love it, but liked it. This sounds to me like something that I have to tinker with so that she will drink a whiskey drink and not even realize it, because she likes the apple. She likes hard cider. She likes apple cider. And she loves spices like, fall spices, like
the warm spices.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's perfect for her.
Yeah. Sounds great. So I will definitely do that. What do you call it?
I called it the quarantine cooler.
Quarantine cooler. All right. I like it. I will definitely play with that. Jane, thank you so much for coming in. Yeah. And I'll let you know, what proportions I came up with, and then you can make it and tell me, I like it better this way instead.
I'd like that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jane. I really appreciate you coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for tonight. Many thanks to Jane Love for stopping in. It seems to me that knowing more about SAG-AFTRA in these uncertain times is a good thing, and I hope you enjoyed hearing about union membership benefits as much as I did. Don't forget to check out the sponsor for tonight's episode, Squeaky Cheese Productions. They're on the cutting wedge. They're on the web at squeakycheeseproductions.com, and I'm very grateful for their support of the audiobook Speakeasy. As always, you can find the Audiobook Speakeasy on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Podbean, and all the apps that pull from Apple Podcasts. And you can find me at richvoiceproductions.com, where I've got some samples and links to audiobooks I've narrated, and where I'm also posting episodes of the Audiobook Speakeasy. If you're enjoying our Speakeasy chats, please take a few minutes to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And if you're not enjoying them, please find a podcast you do enjoy and leave them a review. If you think this show is educational, entertaining, or valuable simply because it gives you an excuse to sit down and enjoy a cocktail in an otherwise hectic day, I'd really appreciate it if you'd add a buck or two to the tip jar. You can make a per-episode donation by signing up at patreon.com/audiobookspeakeasy, or you can make a one-time donation by visiting paypal.me/audiobookspeakeasy. Any financial support is greatly appreciated, as it helps me keep the lights on here in the Speakeasy. Until we see you here in the Speakeasy again, I hope you can find some time to enjoy an audiobook. Cheers!